This is Radio EcoShock from the April 2010 Degrowth Conference in Vancouver, Canada. You are listening to Dave Hughes explain the energy options for Canada and the United States.
Coal, cumulative consumption of coal by the human race. We've consumed more energy in terms of coal than we have in terms of oil and gas. 90% of all the coal ever consumed has been burned since 1910, half since 1973, 10% since 2003. Coal is now the fastest growing fossil fuel source in the world. Production and consumption of coal in the world. The story of growth in both production and consumption is the Asia Pacific, China, India, Australia. If we look around the world at where the remaining hydrocarbon energy is, it turns out about 60% of what's left of the world's hydrocarbons are contained in coal. Peak coal. Coal once was considered a fuel for thousands of years. There's been several very good studies done in the last 2 or 3 years suggesting a global peak in coal production by as early as 2025 and a peak in China in about 2020. This is one of them by Energy Watch Group out of Germany. Another one, a very credible study out of Caltech by a fellow by the name of Dave Rutledge, suggesting peak coal in 2021 and a global peak of all hydrocarbons in 2020. Rutledge looked at basically a scenario of liquidating all the hydrocarbons that can be produced at a net energy profit as fast as we can produce them. And he concluded that we can't get carbon levels in the atmosphere up to even the lowest IPCC scenario. Not to say that carbon is not a very important issue going forward. It's also to say we have this depletion issue that we have to deal with. If we look at Rutledge's forecast of remaining hydrocarbons yet to be produced, when I was born back in 1950, 95% of the ultimate recoverable hydrocarbons had yet to be produced. Today, we produced about 42%. If we keep burning them as fast as we can produce them, 80% will be gone by 2050, 98% gone by 2100. And considering how incredibly useful hydrocarbons are as a dense form of energy, that's an incredible problem for future generations. I'd like to point out that we're going to need hydrocarbons to build the infrastructure that comes next. A 2-megawatt windmill, for example, has 260 tons of steel in it, which requires 300 tons of iron ore and 170 tons of coking coal to make, all mined and transported with hydrocarbons. Rutledge looked at CO2 concentration in the atmosphere if we burn all remaining hydrocarbons as fast as they can be produced. And he suggested we could just get to Hansen's earlier danger threshold of about 450 ppm in the atmosphere. Rutledge suggested a peak temperature in his scenario of burning all the hydrocarbons as fast as we can produce them in about 2064 at about 1.5 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels. If we look at forecast of world electricity generation, coal is forecast to be the major fuel source for electricity going forward to 2030 at least, followed by natural gas. Nuclear grows in real terms but loses market share. Large hydro grows in real terms but loses market share. And renewables, this is geothermal, wind, photovoltaic. If we can grow those by quadruple, renewables could be 6% of forecast consumption. And that's what I mean when I say beware of scale. Renewables have to grow a lot, but they're difficult to scale compared to the throughput we get from fossil fuels. U.S. electricity generation by fuel, coal, 44% in 2035 in this forecast. And renewables, if we can somehow grow U.S. renewables by a factor of 5, renewables could be 11% of U.S. generation. And this is what that renewable forecast looks like. It turns out that wind grows by more than 6-fold, but the most important source of renewables is wood and other biomass, growing by 7 times. Photovoltaics, if we grow photovoltaics by 30 times, they'll still be less than 0.5% of forecast consumption. There's been a huge amount of wind generation capacity built in the U.S. over the last decade. This is the installed wind generation. And if we look at the properties of wind, wind is not a very favorable source of electricity because it's intermittent and it's unpredictable. And this is the amount of electricity you actually generated from wind over the last couple of years compared to the installed capacity. It's about 31% because of intermittency and unpredictability. What about nuclear globally? It turns out that the 430 nuclear plants in the world are all getting old. Many of them were built back in the 70s and 80s with a 40-year lifespan. So those plants either have to be repowered or decommissioned and replaced with new plants. And this is a trajectory of nuclear in the world. If we only commission 2 or 3 nuclear plants per year, to keep nuclear capacity flat, we need to be building somewhere around 10 to 12 nuclear plants each year. We're not doing that. Hydrogen, the so-called hydrogen economy, is it the silver bullet? Well, in fact, hydrogen is an energy carrier. It's not an energy source. Most hydrogen in the world is made from steam reforming natural gas. And if we do that, we lose 30% of the energy in the gas. We can make it with electricity, but again, we lose 30% of the energy in the electricity. Because of these energy losses in conversion from other forms of energy to hydrogen, it's likely not going to be more than a niche fuel going forward. The U.S. National Academy of Sciences has published some very good papers on the hydrogen economy, looking at things like storage, distribution, fuel cell cost, and longevity. And there's a huge amount of problems. There's no such thing as a free lunch when it comes to energy. A comparison with hydrogen and other ways of carrying energy. This is energy density by volume and by weight. And it turns out that batteries are the worst way to carry energy, followed by compressed hydrogen gas. Liquid hydrogen is better, but we have to keep it at minus 253 degrees centigrade, which is problematic. But nothing can compare to the energy density, convenience, storage ease, and so forth of gasoline, diesel fuel, and propane. The last piece of the sustainability puzzle, the whole issue of population growth and aspirations of growth and consumption, particularly in the developing world. We've heard already tonight there's a great inequity in terms of per capita consumption of energy in the world. Canada is at the top of the food chain. Canadians consume 6 times the world average, 7 times China, 29 times India. The problem is 3/4 of the world's population are below the world average of energy consumption. And these people aspire to consumption levels of the first world. Oil into China, for example, China was a net exporter of oil up until 1993. 2008, it imported over half of its oil. India now imports 3/4 of its oil. The rest of developing Asia, more than half of its oil, in competition with the U.S., Japan, and everybody else that wants imported oil. If we look at per capita consumption in the world, we can see how Canada, for example, compares to Europe. Canadians consume 3 times as much energy as the average European, and vastly more energy than countries like India or China. CO2 emissions. Canada and the U.S. consume about 20 tons per capita, more than 4 times the world average, about 4 times that of China. I wasn't too surprised about Copenhagen, considering how vastly above all of those developing countries we are in terms of our per capita consumption. World population forecast to hit 9.2 billion people, U.S. Bureau Census in 2050. If we plot motor vehicles on that same vertical axis, there's 850 million motor vehicles in the world, 240 million in the U.S., 50 million in China. China is now the world's biggest market for motor vehicles. 70 million new motor vehicles built in 2008, about the same number of net people added to the planet. Food, hydrocarbons are used in production of food, things like feedlot beef, this is a net energy for different ways of getting food. Feedlot beef, very inefficient. Coastal fishing, much more efficient. Range-fed beef, very efficient. The U.S. food system has gone from 1-to-1 to 10 to 1 in the 70s, and that's about where it is now. Diesel fuel, nitrogen from natural gas, pesticides, and so forth. Returning to the dilemma, 5.3 times as many people as in 1850, each person consuming 8.6 times as much energy, 46 times the consumption of 1850. If you believe the reference case forecast out of the EIA in Washington, this is what the world would look like in 2030 if that was possible. 6.6 times as many people as in 1850, each person consuming 9.5 times as much energy. A world that consumes 63 times as much energy as in 1850, 89% non-renewable. Anyone who believes exponential growth can go on forever in a finite world is either a madman or an economist. The term sustainable growth is an oxymoron. Just to wind up, the energy sustainability dilemma, in my mind, will be the defining issue of our time as the economic growth paradigm abuts physical limits to growth. Although Canada is likely to be able to meet its domestic energy requirements from internal sources through 2030, it will not be exempt from economic fallout of global energy resource limitations. The climate change dialogue, for the most part, excludes consideration of resource limitations on growth. And I'm talking about big climate in big governments, not particularly this group, and hence leads us down some counterproductive pathways, although initiatives on conservation efficiency and renewables fortuitously also address the energy question. Hydrocarbons represent an extremely convenient, dense form of non-renewable energy for which there are no scalable alternatives. They will be needed for the development of infrastructure for the next paradigm of more sustainable human development. A sustainable energy future is not out of reach, but will be hugely challenging. Several Manhattan projects. We best get on with it. Thank you very much.
You just heard Dave Hughes, a Canadian energy researcher, given what is now known across North America as the talk. As he makes numerous presentations with his graphs and helpful facts, Dave's kind of an energy Al Gore, don't you think? This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're listening to recordings from North America's first degrowth conference held in Vancouver, Canada from April 29th to May 2nd. One of the principal organizers was Conrad Schmidt, head of the Work Less Party, and job sharing is one of the tools available to keep people going as we share sustainable life. Here is a short clip from York University professor and no-growth advocate, Peter Victor.
In my work, I try to see whether we could run our economy in a very different way so that we could still live good lives, we could have high levels of employment, we could reduce poverty, we can reduce the pressures on the environment, and all without relying on economic growth. And the work I've done, where I use a lot of numbers and computers and things of that sort, suggests that yes, it can be quite feasible for us to live very good lives, particularly those of us already living in wealthy northern countries, without having to rely on ever-expanding economies. At this conference, which is concerned with degrowth, the question that I've been looking at is a little tougher, and that is that it's not just a question of stabilizing our economy, but possibly shrinking the economy. Could we have good lives if the economy was smaller than it is today? And that's tougher to do than simply stabilizing the economy where we are, but it is possible. It would require more dramatic changes, in particular, as one example, shorter work hours. One of the ways that we can ensure high levels of employment, even if we're not expanding the economy, is if we share the amount of work among more people. And as a very recent example of this, in the recession in Canada where I live, the unions in the car industry, rather than let their co-workers be fired, all agreed to work less so that everybody would stay in the job. Well, that was a short-term solution to what was seen as a short-term problem. I think that's actually the seeds of a long-term solution to our problems, and it's just the sort of thing that we have to do. Well, one question then is, what do we mean when we say that people can live a good life even if the economy is not growing? To answer that question, you have to think about what's really important in life. Of course, we all want to be well-fed and well-housed and clothed and have the ability to move around. But we also know that we want time to spend with our families, time to spend with our children, time with our friends, time doing sport, time doing things which are not particularly burdensome on the environment. So one of the things we have to do is to remove the obstacles, which could be in the tax system, they could be in the system of employment, that are preventing people from working the number of hours that they in fact truly wish to work to have a better life.
Find that clip of Peter Victor on YouTube. We only have time for one more speech from Vancouver's Degrowth Conference. Remember, the idea is we're headed for a collapse due to overuse of the planet's resources, plus a sudden demand for equality of life from billions more people in the world. Should we wait for war and famine? Or can we still plan not just to limit our consumption, but to reduce it drastically? Collapse or degrowth seem to be the only options left. Let's say we want to keep high-tech solutions like hospitals and reasonable use of rapid transportation like high-speed trains, and we want everyone on the planet to have enough to eat without using up the soil or poisoning the planet with pollution. How many humans can Earth really support in this way for thousands of generations? Jack Elpert has figured that out. The reality is shocking. Here is Greenpeace founder Rex Whaler introducing Jack.
Graphs are a way of talking about change over time. So when we're talking about stabilizing and reducing human population, we're not talking about going out on the streets and killing people. We're talking about things such as women's rights, contraception available, global education to help families reduce their numbers and help communities stabilize themselves. Now, one person that has done a lot of work in this and has also done some work in looking at what he calls time blindness, our inability to see how these changes magnify over time, is Jack Alpert. Jack worked with General Motors, did a lot of work on trying to communicate to people to use safety belts. He found out how difficult that was, and he has since gotten into studying how people process important information. Those of you who are parents know how many times you have to tell your children something? Many times. And how do people actually process this important information that we're hearing tonight, and how do they start inculcating these ideas into the way they live their lives? Jack also did some work at Cisco Systems as a training manager. He now works with the Stanford Knowledge Integration Laboratory called Skill, and he wants to talk to you a little bit tonight about what he thinks is a sustainable human population level. Now, remember, we're not talking about going out and killing anyone. We're talking about finding ways that we can reduce our population over a period of time so that in 100 years we're not on a planet that's going nuts with 15 billion people, half of them starving to death. We're on a planet with a lot less people living good, rich, happy lives. Ladies and gentlemen, Jack Alpert.
This is a great group.
It's a great conference, and I'm really glad to be here.
This thing about seatbelts, I put them in cars in 1968, and people wouldn't wear them. And it made me feel pretty bad because we made the probability of dying in your car go from 1 in 200 to 1 in 26,000. So it was a no-brainer. Put your seatbelt on, you wouldn't die in a car accident. Well, the thing that really got me out of engineering was the fact that polio vaccines did exactly the same thing. So polio vaccines did the same thing. And the difference was that the same mother that would get her kids vaccinated wouldn't put on her seatbelt. And I quit engineering and I started to study how people gather, process, and evaluate information. And what I learned is they can't connect the dots. Okay, so I wrote an interactive computer exam for sixth graders. And it was a little problem where how things played out was the important way to figure out how to make the decisions in the first year. So you made decisions over the consecutive years. Anyway, they didn't do very well. And since I was at Stanford, I gave it to a bunch of Stanford students. Now, you got to believe that the Stanford students are brighter than the average Palo Alto sixth grader, but they didn't do very well either. So then I gave it to a bunch of Stanford faculty. And you can imagine that they didn't love me because the results were, and this was prototyping. We're all prototyping. And because it's Stanford, I gathered together all the Nobel laureates and all the Wolf Prize winners. And from the scores at this preliminary evaluation, the Nobel laureates and the sixth graders are about the same in looking at the future, okay, and looking at the present, taking the structure, pushing it out forward and saying, oh, I don't want to go there. So we're all about the same. Okay, so that's what I did for 40 years. And it takes a little time to explain it. It's called how we deal with nonlinearity. So I'm not going to do that tonight. I just wanted you to know that we're all kind of crippled. What you heard from, let's see, David, Anita, Rick, and Bill was, it's kind of black out there. Our future doesn't look very good. But I didn't see anybody run for the exits because they wanted to change their lives. So what I want to do tonight is show you a little video that says, when I run the numbers for how many people could live in the world and have it be sustainable and peaceful, it looks like this. And I'm going to try and make you think about how many people can actually live in the world.
Species extinction is caused by too many people. Depleted fisheries caused by too many people. Starvation, too many people. In fact, overpopulation causes genocide, migration, and probably climate change. What number is not too many? My estimate, below 100 million. How did I arrive at this number? We know that rich people consume a lot. Poor people consume very little. Most of us fall somewhere in between. All of us together create a burden of, let's say, 20 footprint units. The richest 20% create 16 of these. The remaining 5.1 billion create only 4 units. I'm sure you know the world's population is greater than 6.4 billion. Using this number eliminates a need for a calculator, and the conclusions will be the same. The average home of the richest 20% looks like this. The poorest 80%, more like this. This injustice creates social conflict. However, expectations that the 5 billion poor people will achieve the average rich well-being keeps the social conflict from exploding in our faces. What if they succeed? Then the human footprint increases from 20 to 80. 20 footprint units is already enough to exhaust and degrade Earth. 80 would do it 4 times faster. If a more equal distribution of the Earth's bounty is necessary to limit conflict, it must be facilitated without increasing this total human footprint. Either each person in the rich group must reassign 75% of his or her consumption to the poor, or global population must contract to a quarter its present size. To attain a more peaceful world requires lowering the population to 1.6 billion. However, even if we could attain a global population of 1.6 billion people, the sum of all these numbers, and, for example, Canada had 8 million instead of 32, England had 15 instead of 60, and China had 320 million instead of 1.3 billion, and all of these other regions had one quarter of their populations. Notice the United States had 87 million rather than 350. And each of these countries enjoyed an average North American lifestyle, this new world would not be eco-sustainable. We would still be consuming our fossil fuel and water to extinction. We would still be reducing production of renewables like fisheries. And we would still be reducing the natural recycling and absorption capacities of our ecosystem. The world's sustainable population would be smaller. How much smaller? There are many ways to calculate the world's sustainable population. Take any non-renewable supporting resource, for example, oil, and ask how long it would last for different populations. Our oil would last 500 years if we had 100 million. Take any non-exhaustible resource, for example, hydropower, and ask how many people will it support if other energy resources, for example, fossil fuels, are not used. The answer is near 100 million. Take any renewing resource and ask how many people it can support if the usage rate does not degrade its supply. Let me provide calculations using soil as an example. Most farming activities lower both soil quality and quantity. Plowing and runoff erode soil. Crops mine the soil's minerals. Therefore, soil is lost in the farming process. All would be gone if it were not for the natural processes that generate new soil. Sustainable farming practice means the amount of soil lost equals the amount created. However, on average, today's farming techniques lose soil 16 times faster than Mother Nature makes it. That is, it would take 15 years to replace what was lost in a year of farming. On average, to be sustainable, after an acre is farmed, it would have to remain fallow for 15 years. This means we can farm only 1/16 of our land. We can feed only 1/16 of the 1.6 billion people. The peaceful population living at North American lifestyles with sustainable soil practices is 100 million people. Wait a minute. We're not finished. Even a reduction to 100 million is not sustainable. Humans strive for better well-being. For example, people prefer to live longer. An 86-year lifespan is better than an 85-year lifespan. However, an individual who lives 1 year longer increases his lifetime footprint by a little over 1%. Just to accommodate this 1 year increase in lifespan, the population of 100 million would have to decrease to 99 million. There are thousands of lifestyle improvements that would require similar decreases in population. As long as people yearn for eco-sustainability, peace through social justice, and ever-increasing well-being, the global population will have to continue to decrease below 100 million.
Thank you. I didn't do this to rain on this party. It just means that how far we have to go to get rid of the problems that we have today is a very long way from where we are now. And we should look consciously at what we're proposing and see if it gets us anywhere near what we're wishing for. Thank you.
That short talk barely touches the depths of Jack Alpert's experience and thinking about humanity. For example, he's developed a theory that explains our inability to deal with long-term problems like limited energy or climate change. He calls it time blindness. Jack has agreed to do a future interview with Radio EcoShock, but in the meantime, you can watch a full-length video at the website skill.org. That's skil.org with just one L. And we've hardly covered the many presentations and discussions from the three-day conference in Vancouver at the end of April 2010. You can find a couple more speeches on the Economic Crisis page in our audio on-demand menu at ecoshock.org. Conference organizers are also offering a DVD of the entire proceedings with screening rights. Find the details at www.degrowth.com. And that website is d-growth.com. My thanks for permission to record and broadcast what you have heard today. For a quick introduction to this movement and its intellectual roots, look up degrowth, all one word, at Wikipedia. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. I invite you to cruise our archive of past programs at ecoshock.org for a lot more ideas about simple living, real sustainable energy tech, and ways to live in a just and lasting world. Thank you for listening.
Of the world is getting me caught up, chasing the clock, and I wish I could stop it. Just need to breathe, somebody please slow me down.